ahead and have a seat here over to your right. And if you're lacking some of those, again, on your own time, take your atlas, pages 4, 5, and 6, and 7. 4, 5, 6, and 7, and you'll find all those. Ken, can you bump that over? Thank you very much. So we're going to go ahead and look at some things together. That's just an activity to get your wheels turning, to identify some things that are very familiar, you've heard of a lot, and some things not so familiar. But all of that is to help create the framework that we're going to be working with. So very good to be together. Let's start with a prayer. Ray, would you lead us, please?
Heavenly Father, thank you that we're here today, tonight, and thank you for the preparation that Philip's taken. And be with us now as we go through this time. Help it to be fruitful for your sake and for your benefit, and that we're able to remember things that are help us to remember more of the lessons coming in Genesis, that we have a deeper knowledge of it, and it's a fruitful time. And bless those of us here, and bless those who can't be here for various reasons. We can minister to them and help them in any way. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
So when you go see a play, when the curtain opens, the first thing you see usually are not actors. It's the set. And let's say you've never heard of this play, you know nothing about it, and you go to watch the play and the curtain opens, just by the set, you immediately get an idea. If you look at that, I mean, I don't know about you, but that's got to be a murder mystery. Okay? I mentioned Agatha Christie the other day, just right out of an Agatha Christie novel. That's what Bible geography is. It's the set for, and I use this term story, a narrative for the story, for the stories. And of course, all the stories create a story. As we talked about Sunday, the great love saga between God and humans. That's what the Bible is about. So we're going to be looking at the geographic stage for the Old Testament. Now, 2 years ago, was it 2 years ago? 3 years. It was a few years ago. We did New Testament geography. And yes, we plan to go outside in February. And now I'm joking, we'll stay inside. It was in the spring, remember, we did things on the porch and the weather was so nice. Remember how it was so nice being out there? No, we'll stay inside since we're in the wintertime. But we'll do some of these activities and groups and tables and stations and things like that, because geography lends itself to hands-on work. And it's just a really good time. We bring the teenagers in here for us all to interact with each other and learn with each other in a different way. So we're going to focus in this class on Wednesday nights for the next 3 months on Old Testament geography because of the readings that we're doing in the narratives from Genesis to Esther. So just like a play set is a set for the drama of the Bible has a set. It's the lands, it's certain features of the lands like rivers and mountains. And so this is where it all plays out, and it's important to understand these things. So I want to give you some things to look at here to appreciate why we do this. And if you want to take notes, the backside helps to guide you. The map that I gave you, you can use the backside for these notes. If you want a notebook, there are some three-ring binders back there. If we run out, I get some more. If you want to organize this in your own kind of folder, go for it. But you'll get a sheet like this every week, and I'll punch it for you. So what's the value of learning Bible geography? Well, it just enhances the realization that characters in the Bible were real people involved in real events taking place in real places. I do believe that if you had to look at the common denominator of what people think of the Bible, it is probably this. Well, it's certainly an interesting book with a lot of valuable material in it. But, you know, I've heard about this Noah and the flood and Jesus walking on the water and a man being in a lion's den all night long and no lion bites him. And I'm sure this just laden with myth and legend, that kind of thing. They don't realize that as you really immerse yourself in the biblical accounts, it's real. Yes, there are miraculous supernatural things, but it doesn't read like a fantasy. It's not a fantasy. And so these are real people involved in real things that happen in real places, in real time. And understanding that the biblical accounts align with geographic knowledge adds to that realization. And then an understanding of Bible geography enhances the drama of the narratives and the events of the characters. Rick, would you look up Genesis 11, 31? I've got this map up here. I don't expect you to be able to see the details of this map, but I do want to just use it as a generic reference point, and this passage will help us. We'll start learning a lot about Abraham in the coming weeks in our class and in sermons, actually. But in Genesis chapter 11, this is the call, part of the call of Abraham and his family to go to the land of Canaan. Rick, would you read verse 31, please, of Genesis 11?
Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son, Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan, and they went as far as Haran and settled there.
Thank you. There is so much in that. Over the next couple of two, three classes, this is so important. Terah, the father of Abraham, is with them when they migrate from Ur to Canaan, but they don't go this way. There's another place that's listed. What was it? Haran. They go from Ur to Haran. While they're in Haran, Terah dies, and then Abram comes down here with the rest of them, Sarai and Lot and so forth. They go from here up to here to there. I want you to appreciate that in the coming weeks. And understanding that this was no small trip, no motorization, on land, from Ur to Haran down here. And why this, you know, this arc, why this? We'll talk about that even today. And to understand that Abram was doing this because God's calling him to receive these promises he's going to make to him, as we'll see in Genesis 12. You appreciate the dedication, the determination, the complete change of his life when you realize what a big trip that was. And not only what a big trip it was, and we'll see this in 2 weeks, what this place was like compared to this place, night and day. And then he even has a little trip down into Egypt and back to Canaan, going from Ur to Canaan to Egypt. That's the biblical world in the Old Testament to a great extent. So, but to understand the mammoth nature of that trip helps us to understand Abram's faith. Hebrews 11 makes that point. He went out not knowing to the place God called him. Also, the mountains, valleys, rivers, seas, and roads themselves are characters in the story. Some of these points, even tonight, we made 2 or 3 years ago, but I want you to see them again. Exodus chapter 14. Look over there, please. Exodus chapter 14. Zachary, can you read that for us in just a moment? Verse 9 and 10. When I say they're characters, that means they affect the storyline. They either make something easier or harder. They make something possible or impossible. And we talk about mountains to climb. We mean that metaphorically, don't we? Well, sometimes there is a mountain to climb, and it is an obstacle. Or there's a sea. Exodus 14, sea. Yes, this is the Israelites who have come out of Egyptian bondage. They've escaped Pharaoh. Pharaoh has guesses himself by releasing them. And so he sends out the last muscle, the last resource he has, which was his chariot army after the Hebrews. Exodus 14, 9 and 10, Zachary.
The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea, but at by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord.
Okay, so they've got a big jump on Pharaoh and his army. They're way ahead of Pharaoh and his army. But why do they now fear? Where are they?
Right there at the sea.
Right there at the sea. The sea has them blocked off. They are hemmed up against the Red Sea and can't go any further. And here, the chariot army is starting to breathe down their neck. So the sea itself is a character in this narrative. And of course, as you know, God is the next day is going to part the sea when Moses lifts his staff over it. So then the sea is used further as a character. The sea parts, Israelites go through, and then how is the sea used? To destroy Pharaoh's chariot army. The sea is a character. The sea is affecting what happens. That's how realistic the Old Testament narratives are. And fourth of all, just very simply, you actually know where you are when you're reading and studying the Bible. You may think, well, yeah, I'm in 1 Kings. Then that's not what I mean. I mean where you are. Because anytime you read a narrative, that's what we're doing this year. When you read a narrative, you step into those people's shoes, right? Or you step beside of them. Sometimes it's very first person. Sometimes it's very third person. And so it's like you're there, like you're a fly on the wall, and you're hearing Abraham talk with the angels, the conversation they have. You know, you're there in the courts of Pharaoh when Moses goes and says, the Lord says, let my people go. You're there a witness to this. Well, where are you? You're not just in Genesis. You're not just in Exodus. You're in Canaan, or you're in Egypt. So that's, it just makes it more realistic there. So I want to go over something that I think was really helpful a few years ago when we did the New Testament, and that's something I call the six phases of the Bible and its geographic scope. And I'll just be shocked if I'll be pleased if somebody goes, yeah, I remember that. Here are the notes. Okay. Who would be likely to do that? Elaine or Scott would probably be the most likely candidates on something like that. But it's like an accordion. Accordion gets squeezed in and it gets smaller, and then it gets pulled out and it gets bigger. Squeezed in and squeezed out. It's like a lens, camera lens, microscopic lens, telescope, whatever. A lens can zoom in on something real close, or it can zoom out. It can zoom in on a detail, on a small field, or it can zoom out on a very wide field. Geographically, you have this zooming in, zooming out when it comes to geography in the Bible. You have this squeezing into a small space or expanding into a big space over and over. And actually, it's a way sort of just to understand the flow of the biblical story. Now, this includes both Old Testament and New Testament. So, for instance, phase one is the world. And as seen in the book of Genesis. So what are the big events that are worldwide events?
Creation.
Human sinning. What? Flood. The flood. These are all worldwide events, right? But then things get squeezed down with the calling of Abraham. Abraham is here, as Rick read, goes to here and then here. It gets squeezed down to this Fertile Crescent. We're going to come back to that term. We're going to really elaborate on the Fertile Crescent in just a few minutes. But then it's worldwide, and then it's just this area. What are some events that take place in Genesis in this area? Call of Abraham. What else? And before Abraham, between the flood and Abraham, they tried to build what?
The Tower of Babel,
which is right in here.
Eden, somewhere in that area.
Yeah. One of those maps actually will tell you where Eden is. There is a map back there that has Eden. And I thought about not putting it up. And I thought,
rivers flowed from Eden.
Yeah, there's Tigris and Euphrates, but those are big rivers. Then who knows where they were flowing at that time, how extensive they were. Anyway, but yeah, you got Eden there, but Fertile Crescent. And what else is happening after Abraham? Isaac, where does he get a wife? Up in Haran. The servant of Abraham went up here and got him. Okay. What happens to the family of Jacob? Where do they have to go? They have to go to Egypt. And they are preceded there by Joseph. And so you got this Fertile Crescent activity here in the book of Genesis. And then you have it squeezed down more narrow. The Israelites end up in Egypt, but end up going where after they become a huge number of people? The promised land of Canaan. And so things focus on Canaan all the way from Exodus to Nehemiah. You have this extreme focus on Canaan, which is at first called Canaan and occupied by many different peoples. And then it's called Israel because Israel conquers it. Now they leave there, but they come back to that place. So there is this focus on that area from Genesis to Nehemiah. In the fourth phase, again, when Israel sins and they refuse to repent and they start, you know, dividing and collapsing, who does God use to punish them? The Assyrians and the Babylonians. They are Mesopotamia. This is Tigris, Euphrates River Valley. They are based over here and they come over here and conquer. They come over here and they engage the Egyptians in battle. And the Israelites are caught in the middle. Where Josiah is killed because of that. He's trying to run up here and fight the Assyrians. Or the Pharaoh Necho does, and Josiah goes out and fights him. So again, we have a Fertile Crescent activity with Assyrian and Babylonian captivity. And then we come to the New Testament. And it shrinks back down to Palestine. Why is the focus on Palestine? Now it's called Palestine. That's what the Romans called it. Why is it called Palestine? Why is the focus now on Palestine? What happens now?
Jesus.
The Son of God occupies this little strip of land. That's the only place he went. Between Galilee and Jerusalem. That's it. This little strip of land. So the whole focus of the Bible is shrunk down to that. But then the accordion expands, right? Because in the book of Acts and in the letters, you see that the gospel is taken and it is spread throughout the Mediterranean region, especially preaching here in Palestine and up in here in Antioch and over here to Asia Minor and then over to Macedonia and on and on and on. And of course, there are implications at the end of the gospel as well as things said in the book of Acts and even in the letters, that the gospel is not just going to be limited to the Mediterranean. It's going to go worldwide again. So here we are again, back to a worldwide scope. So the Bible is worldwide, then it's regional, and then it's very local in Canaan, and then it's regional again with the Fertile Crescent, and then it goes back to Palestine again, and then it goes worldwide. So that is what's happening in the Bible geographically. Okay, questions on that? Comments. I think it's interesting that we're focused on the narratives of the Old Testament. The narratives are world-based, like the flood and creation. They are regional, like an empire like Assyria invading other areas. They are community, like things that happen in Bethlehem with David and Jesse. And they're personal. Jacob travels from Canaan, fleeing the wrath of his brother that he had created. And he's up here in Bethel, and he has this vision of a ladder. And he's called to be a follower of God, and he commits his way to God. The connection between earth and heaven. And that's just that one man in that one place. One man in one place. And so it's interesting how that focus is zooming in and zooming out over and over. Comments or questions? So what about the world of the Old Testament? The Old Testament world. Today, basically, the events that we mainly study in the Old Testament have to do with what we call the Middle East. Okay? Let's talk about that term a little bit. That is a European designation. People in the New Testament and Old Testament times, if you said that in their language, they'd have no idea what you were talking about. Or if they had an idea, it would be something different than what you're talking about. This is a result of the way, because Europeans by the 19th century, even before, had become so dominant in the world that in academic studies, their way of doing things tended to dominate starting in the 19th century, even before, but definitely in the 19th century. In the 19th century, as Europeans here looked to the East, they saw the East in three sections. There is the Near East. That is what we would call Turkey today, in some of the areas north of Turkey. Just that region right there, the Near East. Near to what? Nearer to Europe. That doesn't make sense if you're in Japan or if you're in South America, but it's the idea of related to Europe, it's the Near East. And then they spoke of the Middle East, which is what we would call today Arabia and Iran, places like that. And then they talked about the Far East, which would be India, China, Japan, etc. Then by the time you get to the 20th century, you see that designation fading. And this is what you see in popular media today and so forth. And what you have is the designation of the Middle East, which would include everything really from Turkey to almost India. Now, why Middle East? It doesn't make sense like Near East, Far and Middle East and Far East does. But it just caught on, especially because this part of the world became so important in the 20th century for one main reason, and it's spelt with three letters. Right. Exactly right. So this part of the world became so important, and so it had that old designation of Middle East, and now, because all of this is considered like a similar culture, which it's not, because Turks, though they're Muslim, they're very different than Muslims in Saudi Arabia. But this is called the Middle East, and sometimes this is just called the East. The East, which is China, Japan, Vietnam, etc. So when we're talking about the events of the Old Testament, we're talking about what we know today as the Middle East. But biblically speaking, there is a better expression for this area. It's just so much better from a historical standpoint, from a biblical standpoint. And that is the term we've already seen, and that is the Fertile Crescent. Now, when you think of fertile, what do you think of?
Rich soil.
What produces rich soil? There's a lot of things.
Nutrients.
The right nutrients and things in them?
Water.
And water. And there's two ways you get water on dirt. Rain. And then from a body of water, like a lake or a river. Can't be an ocean because it's salt. A river or a lake. And either you can irrigate, which they were irrigating way back in ancient times, by the way. They were irrigating in here in the days of Abraham. Or natural flooding of areas that makes the soil rich. So the definition, I don't have it up here, I'll just speak it. And this is my definition, but I think it works. We're talking about a strip of land adjacent to coasts and rivers where rain falls. It's just how it works, right? The water cycle. You've got to be fairly near water for there to be rain. There has to be some surface water of some variety to produce the weather cycle that produces rain. Like, when is Western North Carolina, where do the biggest snows come from? It's weird, isn't it? The south.
Southeast.
That's right. Coming off the Gulf of Mexico, that moisture, okay, and pushes up into the southeastern part of the United States. When it hits the mountains, it's colder and dumps that moisture. It's just like the hurricane. That water came off the Gulf, didn't it? So it's fertile. It's a strip of land adjacent. Now, adjacent is relative. Can be real close or not so close. A strip of land adjacent to coasts and rivers where rain falls. So you can see it right here with the green shading. I don't care if you can see the letters, but you can see the shading of the colors, can't you? And you can see that greenish area here that goes from Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia means land between the rivers. And that's talking about the Tigris and Euphrates. That was a term the Greeks gave it. But we use it even talking about Old Testament, when the Greeks don't appear in the Old Testament as far as a significant civilization yet. And it goes all the way here. Oh, when did I do this a while ago? When was I doing that earlier in the class? Talking about Abraham. Abraham followed the Fertile Crescent. Why didn't he go this way? What's this called? You got it in your notes? Arabian Desert. You know how big that is? The Arabian Desert is 1 million square miles of desert. 1 million square miles.
How far across is that? Like 300 or 400 miles?
I don't know. Don't put me on the spot like that. Go with what I know, not with what I know.
About a 900-mile trip around the Fertile Crescent.
And it's not so much the distance as it is the terrain. If you want to experience this without going there, watch Lawrence of Arabia. Okay? He knows what I mean. And you'll get an idea of how deserted it is and barren it is. And it's incredible. So, now, I want you to note something, and you can even see it on this from a distance. These colors represent things. These colors represent what? Higher elevation mountains. So look at these mountains here. And then we have these rivers on your map. Look at your map. These rivers cutting here. This river cutting through here. These are the three important rivers. These two, Tigris, Euphrates, and the Nile. More on this later. And then we have the one that's so important to our little strip of land where we shrink down. We shrink down on two important phases in the Bible. On Canaan when the Israelites get there, and then again on Palestine when Jesus arrives. And the Jordan River is so important. Jordan River is so important in the Old and New Testament, isn't it? So, it's this strip of land adjacent to water that gets rainfall. So, I want you to think about what that strip of land does. Again, see it as a character in the Old Testament narratives. So, mountains, rivers, deserts. Big desert here, big desert there. Sometimes this is all called the Libyan Desert, or it's called the Western Desert, and this is called the Libyan Desert. You think about Western Desert, it's on the eastern side of Africa. Oh no, it's just like this is the Middle East to the Europeans, to the Egyptians. This was the Western Desert. And what's the deal with the Egyptians? A big one. The Egyptians are a big deal all through the Old Testament. They're fading at the end of the Old Testament, but have they been influential? We'll look at that later, okay? And this Western Desert, Arabia, ocean, mountains, look what you've got. You've got all these natural barriers. You've got several things happening. You've got natural barriers, and then the sea here. And since this is fertile to some extent, what would you expect to see here? Okay, great. Somebody, let's start here. Like, why trade? What are you trading?
Goods.
What are the main goods?
Food,
agriculture. You'd expect agriculture here. And because there's agriculture here, there must be commerce. And if there's commerce, there must be people. This is where the population centers were. This is where the trade was. And it's because they could grow food there. Now, that produces other things. Technology to make tools, writing, ideas, all kinds of things are exchanged along that route. Okay? So, and here's where I want you to see the interplay here. Because if you look at this, this is not like Indiana corn country. This is not like, you know, Eastern North Carolina, you know, soil. This is not an area that is as lush as what we're used to in the United States. If you spend any time in the American Southwest, and especially in California, you can relate to this. California is probably the most Calm down, Rick. You'll be excited. It's probably the most geographically biblical state.
Geographically.
Okay? Because you've got some fertile areas that are real close to mountains and large bodies of water and very arid areas. I mean, Death Valley. Whoa. I just wanted to get out of there. I was afraid I'd get stranded and just dry up to the nub. So you're really close, these fertile areas, and it's fertile, not like we know it. You're really close to arid regions here and here. So there is this interplay, more the geography as a character, there is this interplay between having water and not having water. Having fertility in the soil and having aridity. And since you're that close to the aridity, periods of drought are not uncommon. I mean, when the southeast of America has a drought, it's nothing like droughts here, or droughts in California, or droughts out in Texas, right? It's nothing like droughts there. We'll say, oh, we're in a drought. We've not had rain for 10 days. What? That's nothing. You can go to some of these places for months and not have rain. So it is in California. So there is this interplay between arid and fertile, between dry and wet. And I want you to think about how this happens over and over and over. I mentioned it a while ago. Why did Abraham go to Egypt? Famine. Why did Jacob's family go to Egypt? Famine. And we tend to think of pestilence, and that happens too, but usually famine is related to drought. So you've got these famine issues. That's even in the New Testament, in Judea. You got famine issues and what's happening with crops, herds, and migrations. People are having to move their sheep, move their goats. People are having to move from this area to the other area. Lot looks out. Lot just doesn't pick any place. He picks a place that was fertile because you only have so many of those places. And so this plays in, which brings us to, I just had to talk about them, camels. Look on page 4 and 5 of your atlas. What's up there in the top right corner? Kathy, you got it right there. You got it right there. Camel. Good old Tim, he knew exactly what animal to put in there. Camels are fascinating. Of course, the first thing you think of camels is what? They don't have to have water for a long time. You're exactly right. Okay, there's two kinds of camels. Now, they have different colors, and they have different shapes, just like cattle and things like that, and horses. But this is basically the two kinds, okay? One hump or two humps, okay? The one-hump camel is called the dromedary camel. You can know it as the D camel. Why? Turn a D on its side. See the D? So if this is the D camel, what do you think this is? This is the Bactrian camel. This is the B camel. Looks like a bee. Get it? See that? Now, the hump is for what? It's like my humps and bulges. It's fat. The humps are fat. So it's for energy. So it's their resource. It's not water necessarily. It's just resource. It's fat. But camels can go at least a week in very hot conditions with no water. A week. They can go for weeks without water in cool conditions. So they have this amazing capacity for going without water. They have to eventually have water, but it's for longer periods than other beasts of burden, for sure. And you'll notice this camel has a lot more what? A lot more fur. This is the camel that was indigenous to the Middle East and Africa, where the weather tends to be drier and hotter. You may know where this camel was. Silk Road, Asia. So Central Asia, which has deserts, but Central Asia is higher on the latitude and it's colder. These camels do great in Central Asia where it gets really, really cold and dry. And so this is the kind of camel that was used a lot through Asia on the Silk Road, bringing spices and things like that. They're amazing animals. I think they're ugly. And I understand that they're hateful to deal with, but they're amazing animals. The word camel or camels is used in the book of Genesis 21 times. Anybody want to guess which is, we're all as a church about doing things biblically, right? So which is our camel? The D camel. This is the biblical camel, okay? If we have to use a camel as a congregation, this is the one we're going to use, okay? We have to move something, this is the camel we're going to use. But that's the camel all through the book of Genesis. Abraham sent his servant to fetch Isaac a wife. And he took camels, and they came back, and she came back riding on a camel. Rebecca did. Camels. All right.
Numbered the camels, typically.
Camels were thrown in with sheep and goats and oxen. An oxen's a generic word that really means cattle, okay? But camels were very unique. Sheep and goats and oxen are very generic animals. You see them everywhere in the world except South America, the Americas, really. But you see them everywhere. Camels, unique. Really fit for this fertile crescent. Why? Because you're so close to arid regions and you're so in danger of arid weather is why. So, one more point. The world of the Old Testament, it's the Middle East today, really the way to understand it and how the narrative flows is to understand the fertile crescent characteristics, but also this, it's the ancient crossroads. I mentioned the Americas a while ago. This is a term used by world historians, and it fits us really well as Bible students. It's the term Afro-Eurasia, which means Africa, Europe, and Asia. For so long, that was the known world. People of this continent knew about people over here, who knew about people down there, who knew about people over there, who knew about people over there. And there was trade. We mentioned the Silk Road a while ago. Between Asia and Europe and Africa. Until the discovery of the Americas, which was populated, but not nearly as populated as Africa, Europe, and Asia was when it was discovered, the Americas are completely cut off. Theory is somehow humans migrated probably out of Asia there. But the Americas are cut off. They don't know anything about the Greeks and the Romans, the Egyptians. The Americans don't even have the will. They have little toy wheels, but they never used wheels on carts. And so it was a different world, the Americas. That's why they called it the New World. So for so long, really until 1450 to 1500, this was the world. And here's another fact. Until 1450 to 1500, you didn't get on a sailing ship and just head out into the sea. You stayed along the coasts, or you detected certain reliable winds, like the winds between India and Africa, the monsoons, and you used those to go out in the Indian Ocean between Africa and India. Or you went across the Mediterranean, like the Greeks and the Romans and others did, the Phoenicians before them. But to go out on the Indian Ocean, way out there, or go out in the Pacific or the Atlantic, which weren't even named that then, you didn't do that. You didn't have the technology to do that until the late 1400s. So if you're moving yourself between Africa, Europe, and Asia, there is some sea travel, but it's mostly land travel. And what's the part of the world that connects by land all three of these continents? It's this right here. We started talking about the Old Testament stage of the events. This is center stage. That strip of land right here, this fertile crescent down to Egypt, and even in particular, this section right in here, this is the only land bridge between Africa, Asia, and Europe. Even over here in the Mediterranean, there's land that juts out. But there's water that runs between it there, Straits of Gibraltar. But that's on the edge. That's on the edge back then. Not much population out there. Where things are happening, this is the crossroads of human experience. And this is where the events of the Old Testament play out. This is real stuff. This is real history. Okay, make sure you get all those labeled on your maps using your atlas, and thank you very much. And I've got to be gone next Wednesday, so Rick's going to do a one-off lesson, and then we'll come back to geography in 2 weeks. Thank you.